On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to the Managed Aquifer Recharge or MAR training. My name is Taylor Vogel and I'm your moderator for today's training. This training is an overview of the online guidance document produced by ITRC in 2023, which you can open and utilize alongside the webinar information presented. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Research Institute of the States, a 501c3 education and research nonprofit corporation affiliated with the Environmental Council of the States. We are a national coalition composed of members from state agencies, federal government, tribal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating in today. Please visit the ITRC website if you're interested in becoming an active member or need to view the full ITRC disclaimer. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review those terms and conditions in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. All right, I now have the joy of introducing today's trainers that were all active members of the ITRC Managed Aquifer Recharge Team. They supported creating the guidance document and volunteered to help deliver the live training today. And before we start, just a quick note, some of the links presented in today's training may be broken or out of date. If you run into any issues accessing the link, you can always navigate directly to the main guidance document and use the table of contents to find the specific sections we're referencing. I will now turn this over to Kelsey from the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality to start us off.
Thank you so much, Taylor. And thank you all for attending this webinar today. Taylor, do you mind opening the poll question so we can understand who our audience is today? To the audience, let me know through the poll your level of knowledge or experience concerning Managed Aquifer Recharge, or MAR, as you'll be hearing it called today throughout the training. The world is facing an increase in the vulnerability and scarcity of freshwater supplies. Managed aquifer recharge is becoming an increasingly important method for improving and supplementing subsurface freshwater storage. MAR has the additional benefit of reducing flood risk, managing stormwater, mitigating subsidence, and controlling saltwater intrusion. All right, Taylor, can we see the results of the poll, please? Okay, perfect. It looks like everyone in the audience is in the right place today for us to help you understand what MAR is and how it can help our world. In the guidance document, we define managed aquifer recharge as the purposeful recharge of aquifers to increase water supplies for subsequent recovery or environmental benefit. This training is intended to help you understand MAR and its applications. Recognize MAR as a process rather than simply a single technology. Realize that MAR can be widely applied and understand MAR's role in the future for addressing water supply resilience and climate impacts. Even though water rights are an integral part of the MAR process, they will not be discussed during today's training. The process and efforts required to complete an engineering feasibility study, alternatives analysis, preliminary engineering report, and engineering design with plans and specifications are beyond the scope of this internet-based training. However, these topics are covered in the guidance document. Why are we talking about, excuse me, why are we talking about managed aquifer recharge? Why is it important? Currently, the planet is experiencing wide-scale changes in its climate system. There is extreme flooding, drought, and the ever-increasing demands for human consumption of fresh water. While groundwater recharge is a natural phenomenon, MAR can be used for enhancement or restoration of recharge in environments where there is not enough water or perhaps too much water. Overall, MAR is impactful because it is a process that ensures groundwater as well as surface water resources remain dependable for generations to come. In our guidance document, the MAR process is depicted as the model on this slide. There are four key components in the MAR process. These components are represented by the individual circles surrounding the central managed aquifer recharge circle. The first component is intended use. For example, what is your water challenge? Do you have too much water or not enough? In today's training, we will talk about how the MAR process can assist with resolving these problems. The next key component is source water. During the MAR process, water is being placed into an aquifer. Where does this water come from? We will learn more about different types of source water and issues to acknowledge during this section of the training. The third component is the receiving aquifer. This is the geologic formation that is receiving the source water. What are the characteristics we need to consider regarding the receiving aquifer? These considerations will be discussed today. Finally, the last component is recharge technologies. How are we getting the source water into the receiving aquifer? There are different methods for accomplishing this, and these methods will be explored in the training. By asking these questions about the four components of MAR, do you see why the arrows are double-headed between the components on the model? This is because you might be starting your MAR project from any one of the four components. Today's training will follow the four components of managed aquifer recharge, which mimics how the guidance document is laid out with section numbers referenced. The intended use section will be covered by Linda Bowling. We will learn more about source water from John Mitzdarfer. The receiving aquifer has many characteristics to consider, which Adam Jansen will discuss in his section. Finally, the different technologies for recharging the aquifer will be covered today by Jeff Davis. After our first Q&A session, John and Adam will present two full case studies, and I will wrap up the training followed by another Q&A session. We were fortunate to be able to assemble 12 case studies from across the country that demonstrate most of the MAR processes and approaches. Like the roadmap on the last slide, each case study is listed by their corresponding section number in the guidance document, shown as sticky notes. Common feedback from ITRC webinar trainings is the need for more case studies. These real-world examples resonate with us because we can relate to the problems being resolved in different parts of the country. So, our subject matter experts will train you on the basics of the four components of managed aquifer recharge, and then at the end of each of their sections, we'll show how those concepts were utilized in the Walla Walla Basin watershed. After we cover the basics of the four components, our trainers will show how they are used from project planning through implementation in the SWIFT project in the Coastal Plain of Virginia and the San Antonio, Texas water system. Let me give you all a quick introduction to the Walla Walla Basin Watershed case study. This will set the stage for when Linda, John, Adam, and Jeff demonstrate how the components of MAR apply to this project. This watershed covers an area of dry land in the rain shadow of the Cascade Mountains, located in southeast Washington and northeast Oregon. The soils of this watershed consist of coarse sand and gravel in the alluvial areas. Fine-grained glacial flour and wind-blown sediments in upland areas overlay clays, which in turn grade into volcanic rock with depth. The Walla Walla Basin watershed was experiencing several water challenges. An increase in residential and commercial development caused water levels in the Walla Walla River to drop, which degraded habitat conditions for steelhead and bull trout. Stream flows were insufficient to support aquatic life. Floodplain function was lost due to channelization and flood control. In addition, there was greater than 30% seepage loss from the river into the groundwater. It was determined that groundwater mitigation was required to achieve river restoration. Let's keep these challenges in mind as we revisit this case study throughout the training and see how the MAR process can help. I am now turning the training over to Linda Bowling with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to take us through the intended use section. Linda, you're next.
Thank you, Kelsey. Okay. Before I talk to you specifically about managed aquifer recharge project intended use, let me set the stage of why you might want to implement a MAR project. We told you about water resource challenges and how MAR projects can help. That sets the stage for thinking about a MAR project and intended use. On the left, we list six water challenges that communities, regions experience. By implementing a MAR project, as you can see on the right, you can address one or multiple water challenges. These MAR solutions are captured on the right side of the slide, of the right side of the slide. I'm sorry, I meant center, and now I'm talking about the right side. Note that we identify case studies from the guidance document that will provide more real life examples of these intended uses. Let's look at each of these MAR solutions a little closer in the next couple of slides. Let's see here. MAR can provide water supply resilience for communities, agriculture, and industry, small and large, at a time of widespread groundwater depletion and increasingly dramatic swings between wet and dry conditions. Let me give you a real-life example. Today, about 90% of Scottsdale, Arizona receives drinking water from two renewal surface water sources, the Central Arizona Project and the Salt River Project. Due to the shrinkage of available water, Scottsdale, Arizona has asked all residents and businesses to voluntarily cut their water usage by at least 5%. Also, about 1,000 people who live in the Rio Verde foothills suburb area had their water supply cut off by the city of Scottsdale on January 1st, 2023. Scottsdale is implementing water supply resiliency by constructing four wells at strategic locations throughout the city as part of its commitment to maximize renewable water supplies and minimize the use of existing groundwater sources. This will ensure long-term water supply sustainability by recharging high-quality potable water directly into the aquifer when water demand is low, late fall and winter months, and retain the capability to withdraw groundwater during high demand or emergencies. In areas where regional scale groundwater level declines have resulted from long-term withdrawal rates that exceed the rate of replenishment, MER has the potential to offset these declines and make additional quantities of groundwater available in areas where regional scale groundwater level declines have resulted from long-term withdrawal rates that exceed the rate of replenishment. This concept is known as water supply resiliency. The figure demonstrates water supply resiliency. Treated water, as you can see here, is placed into the ground for storage during periods of low demand and then recovered here during periods of high demand. Improving groundwater quality. MER can be used to improve the quality of groundwater in an aquifer that may have water that does not meet drinking water standards. For example, harmful germs and chemicals can get into groundwater from many sources, including fertilizers, pesticides, or other chemicals that have been applied to land by farmers and septic sewage. Chemicals seep to the subsurface and degrade groundwater quality. What are some ways MER can improve groundwater quality? Well, let's see here. Some projects inject treated or fresh water into a formation with marginal water quality to improve the native groundwater quality in the aquifer. Next, some projects have used multiple treatment processes to introduce water of quality compatible with the aquifer system while also providing treatment to meet the needs of the aquifer's intended use. A properly operating system would have a high recovery efficiency as a result of the mixing of injected water, which may allow for recovery of a greater volume of usable water than the injected volume. So that's the third point. Moving on. Saltwater intrusion is the movement of saline water into freshwater aquifers, which can lead to groundwater quality degradation. This occurs when storm surges or high tides overtop areas low in elevation. It also occurs when saltwater infiltrates freshwater aquifers and raises the groundwater table below the soil surface. Saltwater intrusion barriers have been used to prevent saltwater intrusion to protect groundwater resources as early as 1953. For example, an area where a managed aquifer recharge project can make a difference is where freshwater aquifers near coastal areas in Florida are used to address municipal water supply, residential irrigation, and agricultural irrigation needs. Cities and towns, businesses, and agriculture draw much of their water supplies from aquifers, so it is important to protect the aquifers from experiencing any declining water quality. Looking at the diagram on the right, diagram A here illustrates how an aquifer near a coastal location may appear under perfect conditions. Diagram B shows the effects of overpumping of the aquifer, which can cause salt water to be drawn inland towards the freshwater zones of the aquifer. Diagram C shows the use of MER to mitigate salt water intrusion. It involves the injection of fresh water to reduce the inland movement of salt water. This positioning and usage of wells is known as a saltwater intrusion barrier. Flood-managed aquifer recharge, or flood MER, can help reduce flood risk and boost groundwater supplies. MER can also address stormwater runoff by diverting water into permeable aquifers. To learn more about stormwaters, see Section 3.1.4 of the MER guidance document. For example, beaches in Hawaii, Florida, Myrtle Beach, and California have issued no swim requirements at beaches due to poor water quality resulting from floodwater stormwater drainage. Polluted water created from rainfall drainage and untreated sewage released into the water can expose swimmers to harmful microorganisms called pathogens. These pathogens can be present at or near the site where polluted discharges into the water. Flood mop projects can better manage flood and storm waters. Let's use the diagram on the slide to visualize the intended uses of the flood mop project. The flood mop concept involves the collection of high flow flood waters and their conveyance downstream where they are spread across the land to increase flows into adjacent streams and rivers, support agricultural activities, as you see here, create bird terrestrial habitat, recharge depleted aquifers, which enhances water supply resilience, reduces flood risk and increases drought preparedness, improves groundwater quality or water quality, and adapts to climate change. As you think about the concepts described here for a flood MAR project, I encourage you to see section 3.1.5 in the MAR guidance document. Land subsidence. Land subsidence is a gradual settling or sudden sinking of the Earth's surface. Land subsidence often results from compaction of compressible confined aquifer systems, both aquifers and confining units, resulting from overpumping of groundwater and the accompanying reduction of water in the aquifer. Some of the most drastic and best known subsidence resulting from overuse of aquifers occurs in the San Juan Valley, California, where the land level has subsided up to 10 meters in the last 90 years due to overpumping due to drought conditions. This has caused a loss of levee freeboard and subsequent reduction in flood protection, a change of gradient along water conveyance canals, damage to roads and bridges, buried irrigation pipelines, land leveling of fields and collapse of water well casings. Land is important because the valley is a big producer of fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Cattle and sheep ranching are also vitally important to the valley's economy. MAR projects are included in planning to reduce land subsidence by sustaining water levels in aquifers. MAR has been utilized to slow or stop land subsidence in many areas through the injection of water with significant success. Basically, the aquifer is being recharged to reduce or eliminate land subsidence with the added benefit of contributing to water supply resilience. A managed aquifer recharge is being used at several locations in the United States for ecosystem protection and stream flow maintenance. Drought and rising temperatures brought on by climate change, exotic species invasions, and human activities such as grazing and recreation all take a toll on riparian ecosystems. Without a healthy riparian area, land or structures that are too close to the water could be lost. When excess sediments are washed into the stream, the result is increased turbidity and deposition of sediment on the stream bed. Erosion and increased sediment from bank erosion may contribute to decreased water clarity and reduce visibility for fish to find food. The Sacramento River Valley has problems such as habitat loss, water pollution, floods, loss of native species, and other impacts of climate change. This has been caused because only 25,000 of the estimated 500,000 acres of riparian habitat that existed in 1850 remain today. The California Department of Water Resources is exploring opportunities to use MAR flood water for several purposes, including the protection of riparian ecosystems and replenishment of water streams in Sacramento River Valley, California. Now we return to the Walla Walla River Basin case study. The Walla Basin Watershed Council Water Challenge is a declining water supply due to the increase in development. The council is using various MAR technologies for intended uses of water supply resiliency. Let's see here. Protection of riparian ecosystems and maintenance of minimum stream flow. Now that we are back to the roadmap, I will turn the presentation over to John Mistarfer, who will now discuss the source water component of MAR.
Thanks, Linda. Well, good afternoon or morning or wherever it is where you're from. We're going to move on to talking about source water, which is the water that's intended for use as recharge. So there's a variety of different factors that need to be considered for any particular MAR related to the source water. In most cases, the availability of the source water is really the make or break component for the implementation of any project. It's really never enough water out there, so we're always on the lookout for both compatibility and availability. Many potential source waters that bear consideration, each one has varying advantages and constraints in the context of a specific project. So looking at those, far and away the most common source waters are surface waters such as lakes and rivers. We also have other potential source waters, something like things like treated drinking water, highly treated wastewater, captured water, as was mentioned earlier, and floodwaters. We also look at things like industrial process water, which might be like things like cooling waters, agricultural return flows, such as excess irrigation, and potentially in the future, maybe with the economics of things working out, treated produced saline waters from oil and gas production. Also look at things like dewatering systems from mining or construction sites, treated water generated from environmental remediation projects, though water quality issues might be there. And finally, in a few cases, and we're going to talk about this with a later example in the training, groundwater transfer from one aquifer to another. So as we talk about these potential source waters, the availability is by far the major issue that needs to be dealt with. So in context of both volume and duration of flow, need to be considered from different sources. For example, like industrial process water might be limited in total volume, or agricultural return flows, or might be seasonal, so you only get them when you're actually irrigating something. Next consideration is moving water from the area of the source water to the MAR project location. So the proximity and the availability of conveyances are very important considerations and can have significant impacts on the cost of MAR systems. Now, as Mark Twain's famous for saying, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. So another consideration is ownership of the water or the water rights. Again, this can vary from state to state. Or in other different conditions, the ownerships can be very simple and straightforward or very complex. Need to consider potential competing uses for the water. Stakeholder concerns need to be taken into consideration. And finally, there can be regulatory limitations on the availability of the source water, even though the actual physical water is there. Next, source water quality should be considered. Beyond just drinking water standards, there are additional chemical, biological, physical, and radiological characteristics that can potentially limit the availability and the use of a potential source water. So as we look at these, first we have the chemical makeup of the water itself. Things such as emerging contaminants, disinfection products can play a part that make add to the ability to use different source waters. There's biological things. If you're a geologist like me, you typically don't really necessarily think about the biological hazards. Usually they just want to bite you on an outcrop where they've been fossilized for several million years. But things like bacteria and viruses need to be considered. There's just physical properties of the water, temperature, turbidity, total suspended solids. If you're using groundwater, things like naturally occurring radioactive materials or NORM can have an impact. Ultimately, all these pretreatment costs are going to need to be addressed and they're for these different water quality aspects, and they can add significantly to using a particular source water as far as terms of cost. Depending on the MAR's intended use, a MAR project may need to meet federal and state-specific drinking water standards. There may be additional design modifications depending on other federal and state requirements, and also the receiving aquifer characteristics. Regulatory issues are kind of discussed in Section 2.5, and water quality considerations will be discussed by Adam here in a little bit in Section 3.5 in the MAR document. Some other potential source water issues to consider might be public outreach, justice, existing and future competing uses, ecosystem impacts, climate change considerations. What is a source, what an available source water now may not be in the future. Characterization, pilot costs, conceptual modeling development, all of this is going to have an impact on the cost of a particular source water. All right, let's go back to our Walla Walla watershed example. So in this case, the available of the source water and the environmental considerations were addressed through a limited license from the Oregon Water Resources Department for water from the Walla Walla River. The source water was the river water taken from upstream. And the conveyance of that water to the areas where the groundwater substance was so where the water was leaking into the groundwater was using addressed through existing irrigation delivery systems, ditches and things along the watershed. They were already being used. All right, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to Adam to talk about the receiving aquifer. Adam, take it away.
All righty, thanks, John. So the receiving aquifer, as the name would suggest, is what receives the source water in a MAR project. And it's where we realize the benefits of the MAR. So receiving aquifer, we're going to talk about in this section several considerations that relate to this. So some of these are things that you would factor into the choice of a receiving aquifer when you're first starting the project. Some of these are things that you would take into account as far as the feasibility and design of the project. And others are more operational concerns once a project has been implemented. So to start off here, let's do a little terminology. For this training, we consider two types of aquifers, unconfined aquifers and confined aquifers. Now, in reality, it's a little more complicated than that, but we make this simple distinction between the two, mainly to talk about the implications for how we can get the source water into the receiving aquifer. So the unconfined aquifer, which you see on the left, we have more options for how to do that. So for an unconfined aquifer, the water table forms the top of the aquifer, and so therefore the aquifer is open to the vadose zone. And in this situation, we have the ability to infiltrate water from at or near the land surface, and then it will reach the percolate down through the vadose zone and then recharge the aquifer. Now, the opposite case, the confined aquifer, which you see on the right, in this case, we have a lid on the top of the aquifer, which is this low permeability confining unit. So that forms a barrier that prevents us from infiltrating water into the receiving aquifer. And then additionally, you see that the water in a confined aquifer is under pressure. And so we've drilled a well into it here, and you see the water level in the well rises above the top of the aquifer. So because of the barrier and the pressurization, the only way that we can put water into a confined receiving aquifer is to inject it directly into the aquifer under pressure. So we'll talk about recharging an unconfined aquifer here in a little bit more detail. In the image on the right here, you see we've built a pond that contains this dark blue water right near the land surface, and then we're allowing water then to infiltrate through the bottom of the pond down into the receiving aquifer. These squiggly lines on here indicate the water percolating down through the vadose zone, and then when it reaches the aquifer, it forms a mound of higher water table, which you see here, the shading of the darker water kind of piling up on top of the rest of the aquifer. As you might guess, the depth to the water table then is a pretty important consideration for evaluating MAR in unconfined aquifers. So if we have a really thick vadose zone above the top of the aquifer, it's going to take longer for the water to get there, but we also have a lot of thickness available for this mound to form. So the height of that mound is going to be a function of the recharge rate, the specific yield of the aquifer, and also its hydraulic conductivity. But on the flip side, if we have a situation where the water table is pretty shallow below the land surface, then we don't have as much room to play with for formation of the mound. That might limit how much water we can actually put into the aquifer. And if we happen to be located in an area where there are a lot of homes nearby, we wouldn't want the mound to get so high we'd have to worry about flooding people's basements. Mention quickly about water quality. We're infiltrating water into unconfined aquifers, we might be able to get away with a little bit lower quality of source water because this percolation of water through the vadose zone will have somewhat of a filtering effect. And also there may be other biological processes that are occurring there that might help to treat the water and then make it a little bit cleaner by the time it actually gets into the aquifer. So as I mentioned, if we recharge a confined aquifer, the only way we're going to get that water in there is to inject it directly under pressure, which we show on the right here. We're injecting this kind of darker blue water into the aquifer, and we're by doing so, we're kind of forming a bubble of the source water near the injection well that then is then pushing out farther the longer that we inject. The confined aquifer, by definition, is already full of water, so we're creating space for the new source water by displacing the existing native water in the aquifer, and also by increasing the pressure through injection, we get a little bit more space by expanding the aquifer matrix and compressing the water. So the shading here of different shades of blue on the right figure is meant to indicate that there is going to be some mixing here between the water that we're injecting and then the native groundwater. And so that takes place along what we call the recharge front, which is kind of like the edge of the bubble as it moves outward away from the injection well. And so that's the area where chemical reactions might occur between the source water and the native groundwater. And that can have some significant impacts on the overall feasibility and success of the system. And we'll talk about that more a little bit later. But then I finish up the last slide by saying you can get away maybe with some lower quality water for an infiltration case for an injection well system. Because you're putting the water, source water directly into the aquifer, you usually have to clear a higher bar for the quality of the source water. It needs to be very clean, kind of at minimum meet drinking water standards in most cases before you'd be allowed to inject it into a receiving aquifer. On the next three slides, I'm going to run through just kind of various considerations kind of for kind of the initial planning and feasibility, and in some cases also the design of the system, things you might need to think about related to the receiving aquifer. And so first and foremost, you need a site for the project. There has to be some infrastructure that's constructed at the land surface to be able to get water into the ground. And so you have to find land available to be able to build that infrastructure. That can be challenging in an urban environment where there's already been a lot of development. But even in a rural area where it might seem like there's more land available, you're still competing against other land uses such as agriculture or in some places oil and gas production. Moving to the upper right, There's potential for impacts to both water quantity and water quality to the receiving aquifer through operation of the MAR system. Now, because we're putting water into the ground, it's tempting to think that we're always going to be increasing the quantity of water available, but that may not always be the case. In many systems, especially the aquifer storage and recovery type systems, we're putting water into the ground with the intention of then withdrawing it later. The pumping of the ground of the source water back out of the aquifer will create a cone of depression that could result in water quantity impacts to anybody else who has a well in that aquifer nearby. And by regulations, we're not going to be allowed to put a poor quality source water into a receiving aquifer. So you also might think that we're always should always be improving the quality of the receiving aquifer water by adding the source water, but that also is not the case. Mainly because of potential for chemical reactions and always that nagging suspicion that there may be some emerging contaminant out there that hasn't emerged yet that we could find ourselves putting into the aquifer and then wish we hadn't years later. We have a case study that we're going to talk about later in this training from San Antonio, Texas, where a situation where existing users of the receiving aquifer were concerned about both water quantity and water quality impacts as a result of the MAR system. Talk about what the MAR operator did to address those. Moving to the lower left here, existing aquifer restrictions. There might already be some existing administrative restrictions that have been put in place to try to protect the receiving aquifer or that otherwise would make it perhaps a little bit more difficult to locate a MAR project in that area. One example of that, you may be familiar with the US EPA's Sole Source Aquifer Program. So that's designed to protect aquifers that are the only source of drinking water in their area from being contaminated. So for example, if you wanted to locate a MAR project in a sole source aquifer, there may be additional requirements that you have to fulfill to prove that you're not going to contaminate that aquifer. And while we're talking about contamination, the final one on here, proximity to known contamination. As we know, there are plumes of contaminated groundwater out there. Obviously, wouldn't want to locate a MAR project within one of those. But if there happen to be nearby plumes of contaminated groundwater in the receiving aquifer or in an aquifer adjacent that's connected to it, there's potential that because we're adding water to the aquifer as part of our MAR system, we're going to be changing groundwater heads and flow directions, and we may end up changing the size or shape of an existing contamination plume. And if that were to happen, the MAR project operator could then perhaps find themselves liable for increased cleanup costs. So whenever we're making changes to pressures and flow conditions in the subsurface, we may have to worry about geotechnical considerations. So there's three here that we'll talk about on this slide. These are probably the most common ones. First up is seismicity. So this is defined as the prevalence of earthquakes in any given area. And you may be familiar that there are a number of documented instances of deep disposal wells for oil field brines or hazardous wastes that have been linked to causing earthquakes through their operation. Now, we are not aware of any existing MAR projects that use injection wells ever being linked to causing earthquakes. And that's generally because MAR projects are operating at much shallower depths and therefore much lower injection pressures than those deep disposal wells. But still, as part of getting the underground injection control permit for a MAR project that uses injection wells, you may have to do a seismic risk study if you're trying to locate the project in a seismically active area. So continuing on the earthquake theme here, another one we'll talk about is liquefaction. Liquefaction is a technical term for quicksand. This is what happens sometimes in earthquakes when the vibration from the earthquake causes saturated sandy soils to essentially liquefy and lose all their strength. In the image here you see in the middle, there's some soil that was liquefied during an earthquake, and you see how different it looks from the rest of the soil around it. Well, obviously, if the soil turns to a liquid and you have foundations on that, those buildings are going to be catastrophically destroyed. If we're locating a MAR project, especially one in an unconfined aquifer where we might be saturating soils that previously were not saturated, it's potential that we could be increasing the risk of liquefaction and earthquake. And then finally, slope failures, another term for landslides. We have a picture of a landslide here. If you change the position of the water table on a steep slope, you can cause a landslide. So you maybe need to take care in locating potential sites for a MAR project to stay away from areas where you have a lot of surface relief in the topography to try to minimize the potential for this to occur. And then finally, geochemical compatibility. This isn't an issue for every MAR project, but when it is an issue, it can be a real deal breaker. As we mentioned earlier, these images here on the right show, what we call the recharge front, which is where the source water is mixing with the native groundwater kind of on the edges of where the source water starts to move into the receiving aquifer. And there are a number of different chemical reactions then that can occur where we mix these two waters together. First one we'll talk about here is injection well fouling and corrosion. This four-panel picture on here shows the progression of corrosion over time of an injection well screen. So the view here is you're inside the well and you're looking out into the aquifer. The upper left image shows the brand new well screen, and you see the slots in it that are what allow water to move back and forth between the well and the aquifer. But over time, because of the geochemical conditions within the well, the well screen starts to corrode. And then by the time we get to the lower right figure, it's all plugged up. Those holes are no longer open to the aquifer, and we're going to lose a lot of injection capacity. So unfortunately, this is a pretty common issue with injection wells. Sometimes they have to be rehabilitated. There are different treatments you can do to try to clean off some of that corrosion and then restore the injection capacity of the well. But in some cases, these wells just have a lifespan and that they plug up over time, and then you'll have to replace them at specified intervals. Now, besides clogging up the injection well itself, we also have the potential to clog up the aquifer. And there are two different mechanisms we'll talk about here. So the first one is mineral precipitation. If we have mixed together the source water and the native groundwater, and then the chemical reaction that occurs causes solids to precipitate out of solution, then those solids are going to plug up some of the pore space in our formation, change the permeability of it, and potentially make it less suitable for a MAR system. The second mechanism is swelling or dispersion of clay minerals. If there are clay minerals present in the receiving aquifer, in particular, if we change the salinity of the water through introduction of the source water, that may cause those clay minerals to swell or disperse, and then that also will plug up some of the pore space. And this is potentially an irreversible process in many cases. So once this starts happening, you're really in trouble. Now, besides clogging the aquifer, we actually can go the complete 180 from that and actually cause dissolution of the aquifer matrix. This is mostly a concern in carbonate aquifers, so I think limestones or dolomites, where they're very sensitive to pH. And if the mixing of our native groundwater and the source water causes the pH to drop into acidic levels, that may cause those carbonate minerals to dissolve. And then finally, mobilization of naturally occurring contaminants. This has really been an issue for a number of MAR projects, both planned and actually built in the past. It's caused some to be prevented from ever being constructed in the first place, and then it's been a major thorn in the side for some that actually made it to the construction phase. The issue here is that in most receiving aquifers, especially some of the deeper ones, there may be little or no dissolved oxygen. And so under those redox conditions, minerals like arsenic might be present within the aquifer minerals under those redox conditions, but almost any source water we use probably is going to have some dissolved oxygen in there. And by introducing that oxygen into the receiving aquifer, then we change the redox conditions. And then some of those contaminants, like arsenic is the big one, that were previously in the solid phase, then get released into solution. So then if we go to pump that water back out, now it has arsenic in it. We do have a case study in the guidance document number 5.2 that talks about one method for trying to mitigate that situation if you have a receiving aquifer that has arsenic in the solid phase. But these examples show, though, it's very important early on in kind of the feasibility study for a MAR project to do some kind of geochemical characterization of the source water and the receiving aquifer's native groundwater to make sure they're geochemically compatible and that you can avoid some of these really adverse impacts from happening. So modeling, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I've spent most of my career working on groundwater flow models, and modeling is important for groundwater just in general because we can't see the aquifer. So really the only way we can get a good picture of what might be going on underground is to model it. So modeling is very important for MAR projects, just for that reason alone. And it's something that is useful and kind of throughout the life cycle of the project, from when your initial planning stages to, actual O&M and trying to optimize the operation of the system once it's been constructed. So we have four examples of different reasons why modeling is useful for MAR projects. Predictive modeling is probably the one we think about the most. So, like using a model to try to forecast how the system will operate once it's built. That's what we're showing an example of here with these images. This is a model I built a few years ago for a MAR project where we're showing kind of where the source water is going to go in the receiving aquifer over time. So, these blue lines on here are simulated groundwater flow paths moving away from the infiltration site. Which you can kind of see the green location that's a stream bed that's allowing water to infiltrate into the aquifer. And then you see like over 10 years by the bottom figure where we think that water has gone. Often you have to do predictive modeling as part of a regulatory submittal. That's what this modeling was done for, is to get a permit for the construction of this project. Also, in a more interpretive sense, I mean, can use models like this to interpret what's going on in the aquifer. That may be useful once the system is in operation and maybe things aren't going as planned. You can use modeling to understand kind of what's going wrong and what you might be able to do to fix it. And then finally, model results and being able to make pictures like this are very useful for communicating the key concepts of the system to various project stakeholders. Let's take a little break here for a poll question. So Taylor, if you want to open this poll, please. Which of the following here is not a potential challenge related to the receiving aquifer? So four choices here: A, mobilization of naturally occurring contaminants; B, artesian conditions; C, degraded water quality for existing aquifer users; or D, increased risk of liquefaction. I'll give you a little bit of time here to this one over. Alrighty, so it didn't fool anybody with this one. The correct answer here was B, artesian conditions. Now that's just a fancy word for a confined aquifer. It means that the water in the aquifer is under pressure. So certainly there are many MAR systems out there that use confined aquifers as the receiving aquifer, so that's not a potential challenge. Whereas the other three are all things we talked about in this section as, you know, things that could go wrong if you're not careful. So finally, I'll wrap up this section with the receiving aquifer for the Walla Walla case study. So in this case, the receiving aquifer that they used for this project was an alluvial aquifer that's part of the Milton Freewater alluvial fan system. So for those of us who aren't geologists in the audience, alluvial is a word that means deposited by moving water. So this aquifer is comprised of sand and gravel that was originally up in the mountains to the south, and then over time, flowing water in the river carried this sediment out and deposited it here in this area, and then today it functions as an aquifer. So because this was carried by the river, you know, this is a relatively shallow system. It's unconfined. And then they're able to use infiltration to recharge this system. All of these red markers on the map show the locations of the infiltration sites. Now, for this project, I don't know if there were multiple choices available for receiving aquifer, but ultimately it was the intended use of this project that dictated what aquifer they had to use. If you'll recall back to Linda's section at the beginning of this training, we talked about the intended uses of the Walla Walla MAR project. One of those was to improve the riparian habitat and improve base flow in the Walla Walla River. So in order to do that, they had to use a receiving aquifer that was hydraulically connected to the river system, and that happened to be this alluvial aquifer. And so it kind of made the decision for them. So that wraps up our section on the receiving aquifer. So now that we've talked about source water and the receiving aquifer, we need a recharge technology to be able to put those two together. And Jeff Davis from Integral Consulting is going to tell us about that.
Hey, thanks, Adam. Okay, let's see if we can go to the next slide here. Okay, so on this next section here, we're going to learn about some of these recharge technologies. And the way we've classified them, there are a suite of methods used to recharge or put water into the receiving aquifer, as we discussed with Adam. In the MAR document, we have chosen to subdivide the technologies by the receiving aquifer type, either a confined aquifer or an unconfined aquifer. And the confined aquifers generally use injection wells, as you see in this diagram. And then the unconfined aquifers, they tend to have a little more variety using things like infiltration basins, retention structures, dry wells, and infiltration galleries. And we'll go through each one of these five different technologies here. And as you can see from this diagram, the lower boxes highlight the intended use for each of these recharge technologies as discussed earlier. And it spans from improving groundwater conditions to protecting riparian ecosystems, water supply resilience, and also sometimes to mitigate saltwater intrusion. So the first one we'll talk about are pretty common infiltration basins. And there's a lot of different names that infiltration basins are known as across the country and in other parts of the world. Circulation ponds, spreading basins, recharge basins. Sometimes we even call them rapid infiltration basins. But the primary objective here is the same, and that is to passively infiltrate the water to the underlying unconfined aquifer. So the operation of these basins, it can occur throughout the year or sometimes just a shorter period of the year. And there's some there's some important things about these infiltration basins. They generally require an aquifer with infiltration and storage capacity that can accommodate the required objective. These infiltration basins can vary in size, and they can range from really small channels to really large basins. They're generally considered less expensive than other recharge methods, although the basin oftentimes gets clogged over time, which requires some kind of removal of that upper layer. And so there's usually a drying period where that material on top is dried, and then it's scraped from that surface to essentially revive the basin's infiltration capacity. Generally, infiltration basins are less regulated over for water quality issues, largely due to the passive nature of the recharge. Okay, so the next one we're going to talk about is pretty common throughout the country, and that is direct injection wells. I also want to note that sometimes injection wells could also be referred to as recharge wells. These wells directly recharge to the aquifer. And they also can be used in places along the coast to mitigate saltwater intrusion and or subsidence at times. Injection wells definitely require a lot more investigation. That's typically due to a variety of reasons, including water quality, to make sure that the source water that you're using to inject is compatible or doesn't adversely react with the native groundwater formation. The depth of these injection wells obviously varies substantially across the cases that it's used. Clogging, as Adam talked about in the last section, is quite common. And that tends to require back flushing and sometimes other mitigation to restore that recharge capacity. The big advantage of what's really nice about using injection wells is that they have a very small footprint. Like if we compare that to the infiltration basins, that's a smaller footprint, and it can be used in places where there's not a lot of land. So, in more urban environments. These injection wells, however, tend to be pretty expensive. And they're expensive to construct, they're expensive to operate and maintain, and they definitely require some skills and knowledge in the operation of these injection wells. The injection wells is in addition to injecting water into the formation, they can also be used to recover that stored water. When we have that kind of a situation, that's what we refer to those as an aquifer storage and recovery well, or an ASR well. Okay, our next structure we call retention structures. They're typically impoundments constructed to retain water along a natural channel to promote the recharging of an aquifer. That may be a dam or a dike or a levee or some kind of embankment that captures the surface water or runoff. So they tend to be implemented in areas where infiltration rates to the aquifer could be substantial, and that there's no kind of impermeable layer or confining unit that exists that could possibly lead to unintended flooding. Where these retention structures can be really cost effective because they use the natural landscape for their application, but that also sometimes limits their location of where these actually can be used. Okay, next we're going to talk about dry wells. Let's see. Dry wells are what we call gravity-fed excavated pits. They are normally cased or lined and then backfilled with materials such as gravel or stone. They can sometimes penetrate layers of soil that have poor infiltration rates. They also have been used to offset the effects of storm water. So you see an increasing use of dry wells to manage storm water runoff. But now we see that the use of dry wells are also growing in popularity for managed aquifer recharge to augment groundwater supply. They tend to be more cost effective compared to other MAR technologies. They also have a similar, smaller footprint than compared to, say, an infiltration basin, but they also need regular maintenance to address clogging issues. The capacity to recharge water into the aquifer through dry wells is really dependent on the hydraulic connectivity of the surrounding soil matrix. We're seeing across the country greater and greater state and federal oversight to the use of dry wells, largely due to water quality concerns. Okay, and our last one, we're going to talk about infiltration galleries. So these are similar to dry wells, except they typically consist of, you see here in the diagram here, of a perforated pipe installed horizontally within some kind of permeable fill material. This basically allows for rapid infiltration of stormwater runoff. This is where you see these infiltration galleries being used typically. So they're used to prevent flooding, and they also are a means of recharging the groundwater. So they support groundwater replenishment. Different types of these infiltration galleries include things like French drains, lateral drains such as engineered channels, pipelines, and other type similar structures that are developed to divert water into the ground. There are typically both federal and state regulations to reduce the contamination of the groundwater aquifer. These galleries, these infiltration galleries, just like the dry wells, can clog over time and also can be susceptible to plant roots that will reduce the effectiveness of these kind of features. These infiltration galleries are typically placed near the surface or at deeper depths, and the land above can be developed for other areas or other uses. Things like parking lots. You see a lot of times infiltration galleries are installed underneath a large parking lot. Okay, so let's do a poll here and see if you've been paying attention. Okay. So the question is, the reason why injection wells may be the preferred recharge technology are A, land is expensive and the water quality requirements are easier. B, injection wells are inexpensive to build and surface infiltration is too slow. C, the receiving aquifer is confined and the footprint for injection wells is small. Or D, injection wells are more likely to win water sustainability. So I'm expecting 100% here. So let's give you a couple more seconds and then we'll show the results. Okay. So the miss says, oh, 90%. Very good. So the correct answer is C. The receiving aquifer is confined and the footprint of the injection well is small. So that's pretty good. Okay. So going back to our Walla Walla case here, infiltration basins and galleries are used currently in the 19 recharge sites of the Walla Walla watershed. What's really unique about this location is that it's on the border of both Oregon and Washington. So there's been a lot of collaboration over the history of this project to get it up and running. And they developed it kind of in a phased approach, which allowed for an evaluation of cost benefit and then a way to support the project long term. This phased approach is still happening. And they've been able to recharge in excess of 51,000 acre feet since 2004. And probably it's even greater than that because I think these numbers, are probably a couple of years old. Not all of the recharge basins operate every year. Okay, so the Walla Walla Basin Watershed Council used managed rocks for recharged in the Walla Walla Water Basin Watershed to restore the aquatic habitat of the Walla Walla River for both steelhead and bull trout. and to enhance and improve the river and the stream flows. So to accomplish this, groundwater mitigation was required to address the declining groundwater conditions in that alluvial aquifer of the Milton Freewater Alluvial Fan that we've talked about earlier in our presentation, as well as the seepage losses from the river to the groundwater. So water from the Walla Walla River provided the source water, and then using existing irrigation delivery systems, the water was conveyed from the river to the infiltration galleries and the basins located throughout the alluvial aquifer to recharge that aquifer. So, what are the lessons learned, from this particular MAR application? The project In this project, the aquifer maintains a high degree of hydraulic connectivity to the streams, which is important to restoring that aquatic habitat. The project first tried to restore stream flow through conservation, but it ultimately was determined that there was so much connection or connectivity between the groundwater and the river that without increasing the groundwater levels, they weren't able to meet the targets of the restoration that they were looking for. So the collaboration and the development between all the landowners where the infiltration basins are and the local nonprofits that are, interested in that, in the habitat restoration, that's already been in place. And although their target hasn't been met yet, they're still on track to eventually meet their objective of annual recharge of more than 20,000 acre feet per year. So I think what we want to do at this point is we want to open up if there's any questions of what John or any of us have talked about thus far before we go into the case studies. So any questions we can ask or answer for you?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. We do have a question in the Q&A pod that I would like to ask the trainers. What kind of energy difference is observed for a typical pond recharge versus an injection well recharge system?
So this is Linda Boley, and I attempted to address that question in my response. So I'm not sure when you say energy, do you mean injection rate, or are you referring to injection pressure, or are you referring to something different? If you're referring to an injection pressure for recharge wells, I am familiar with that, those types of projects, and oftentimes, in order to determine the pressures that may be used for injection through a well, for the purpose of injecting, sometimes step rate test results are used, and there is some step rate test guidance out there, but step rate tests are used to determine the maximum allowable injection pressure that may be used at some of our injection and disposal sites sometimes as well. But sometimes that's how it's determined.
All right, thanks, Linda. Thanks for expanding on your response in the Q&A pod. I'm just going to ask one more question. What type of aquifer test or tests does one perform to prospect a MAR site? This applies to both confined and unconfined aquifers.
Yeah, I'll start taking a stab at this one. It's some of the similar testing to what you would do for like locating a potable drinking water well, for whether it's a MAR project or just a conventional well field, you need to understand what the hydraulic conductivity of the aquifer is. And so usually that's some combination of a step rate test, I guess, usually is more for well performance, but doing constant rate pumping tests to get an idea of the hydraulic conductivity of the aquifer. You could also do slow testing on smaller diameter wells. And if you're in a bedrock system, you're looking at a more of a fractured aquifer, you may have to do packer testing where you isolate certain sections of the formation and then just pump those individually and see how they respond to get an idea of what the hydraulic connectivity is of just those fractured zones. But overall, it doesn't really look that different compared to, I mean, what a conventional well field would look like as far as testing.
All right, thanks, Adam. And in the interest of time, I will continue with the training and pass this over to John to walk us through a case study. But we will have one more chance for a live Q&A at the end of the training.
Really?
Right, John, whenever you're ready. I think I gave you slide controls.
Yep, you did. Okay. I'm going to move on to our case studies now. All right. So our first case study we're going to talk about is the Sustainable Water Initiative for Tomorrow, or SWIFT. And it's in the Hampton Roads Sanitation District in Virginia, also known as HRSD. I like their acronyms out there. And what you're looking at here pictured is the $25 million SWIFT Research Center built in 2017. It's kind of the pilot project for the MAR project. So this image of Eastern Virginia to the right is roughly encompasses the Hampton Roads Sanitation District, which serves about 1.7 million customers in 18 cities and counties and treats about 250 million gallons of wastewater per day. Now, SWIFT is an innovative water treatment and managed aquifer recharge project designed to enhance the sustainability of the region's long-term groundwater supply and further protect the region's environment. The project will help address environmental challenges such as the Chesapeake Bay restoration efforts, sea level rise, and saltwater intrusion. At full scale, SWIFT is planning to be implemented in up to five of HRSD's wastewater treatment facilities with a total recharge capacity of up to 100 million gallons per day. By the way, that kind of strange donut feature looking thing in the center of the figure is the Chesapeake Bay impact crater, which occurred about 35 million years ago and still has profound effects on the groundwater and surface water systems today. Okay, as we mentioned earlier, modeling projections are an important component of successfully implementing a MAR project. In this slide, we see the projection of 50 years out in time for impacts on the potentiometric surface. The relative impacts of the groundwater table over that 50-year period are shown both with and without implementing the 100 million gallon a day SWIFT project. On the left-hand side, we see reductions, which shown in red, of the pre-development water table, such as almost 70 meters of reductions. On the right-hand side, with the plan, at least in this model, we see mounding, shown in blue. And as I mentioned, that kind of greenish donut in the middle of the feature of the model is the discontinuities of the geologic layers due to the impact crater. All right, so we're going to take a look at the intended use now for the project. As we consider it, we see that it has a variety of drivers. Probably the most important, at least in terms of funding, is the water quality aspects of the Chesapeake Bay. On the other hand, the Potomac Aquifer is also a major source of water for several million people in the area. The decrease of the water table in this coastal aquifer area, coastal region aquifer, comes with its own predictable set of problems, as you can imagine, seeing both subsidence and saltwater intrusion in the coastal region. And in this particular area, they're also looking to protect long-term economic growth by providing additional water supplies. Moving to source water. For SWIFT, the source water is highly treated wastewater from the Clampton Road sewer districts. In this system, there are both traditional water quality goals and advanced treatment for nitrogen and phosphorus. The SWIFT project tested two competing treatment chains, a carbon-based treatment system and a membrane-based system, and decided to go in the lab when they roll out with the carbon-based system using GAC, or granulated activated carbon. The advanced water treatment system was one of the major cost drivers for this particular project. So still on the source water, this diagram shows the complexity of the treatment system that's been implemented for the project. The state-of-the-art nutrient removal wastewater plant treatment facility is followed by carbon-based treatment train. And before SWIFT water is recharged the Potomac aquifer system, the water is treated by several processes, including coagulation, flocculation, sedimentation, ozonation, biofiltration, granulated activated carbon, UV disinfection, and pH adjustment. The system is both technically challenging and closely monitored for the water quality before the water is put into the aquifer. The estimated capital cost at five HRSD facilities for 100 million gallon the 100 million a day gallon capacity is $2 billion, or about 5.5 cents per gallon of capacity. As shown in this table, the SWIFT project is addressing the typical regulatory limits for treated wastewater, in addition to concerns about some of the geochemical interactions with components of the aquifer matrix. So, the Potomac aquifer system is a confined aquifer with interbedded clays and sands. It's more than 1,000 feet in thickness in some locations. The typical TDS, or total dissolved solids of water, is from 700 to 7,000 parts per million. With the secondary drinking water standard set at 500 parts per million, this creates some challenges in terms of getting regulatory approval to inject water that's both compatible and will support the long-term performance of the injection system. Injecting this relatively fresh water in order of magnitude lower ionic strength than the native groundwater reduces the surface charge on the interstitial clay minerals residing in the sand matrix of the aquifer. Adam talked about this issue earlier. The interparticle attachments weaken due to the change in the surface charge and the diminished adhesive forces between the individual clay layers, causing the clays to disperse. Fragmented clays then collect in the aquifer pore spaces, dramatically reducing aquifer permeability. Clogging due to migrating clay fragments is a significant causes significant formation damage and can permanently limit the recharge operations. All right, here's a schematic of the Potomac aquifer system. As you can see, it's quite complex. The fall line on the left-hand side of the figure is where the natural recharge occurs. Before the 100 years of water withdrawal, the places the aquifer was actually artesian would flow it to the surface. The major extraction zone is more in towards the center of the figure, and depending on which of the particular units of the Potomac aquifer system you're accessing, there's some connectivity between these units, but it's basically either semi-confined to confined, depending on where and which layers you're looking at. In the SWIFT project, the highly urbanized, high-priced land in the area and the confined nature of the Potomac aquifer system requires the use of direct injection technology using injection wells. Again, the pretreatment must address both the traditional water quality aspects, but also geochemical compatibility issues to make sure that we don't mobilize any of the clays. And at the current time, the system's gone through injection and flow testing. They've already addressed some of the plugging issues with certain approaches to backflushing. All right, here we're looking at a site schematic of the SWIFT system. You'll notice the injection wells and the monitoring well locations. The infrastructure in the lower left of the is the wastewater treatment system and the Swift Advanced Water Treatment. And the Swift Advanced Water Treatment Center is in the kind of the bottom center next along to the James River. So this is like their first main area that they're going to implement the overall MAR project in one of their systems. And the system provides for deep injection to a maximum depth of about 1,000 feet. Looking at one of these injection wells, here we see the injection well schematic showing how the injection well will access multiple layers in the upper, middle, and lower Potomac aquifer system. You can see about 300 feet of screen length across about 1,000 feet of total depth system. It's very complex and large and expensive injection well. So kind of wrapping it up, the Swift is an ongoing and developing project. The goal was to reach 100 million gallons per day by 2026. They've had some issues. I checked up on things a couple days ago just to kind of see where they're at. And they've been slowed down a little bit by some regulatory issues and some other challenges, things like PFAS and emerging contaminants. But they're working through their manageable some milestones. And at least for their first area along the James River, they've got 85% of the construction's completed. And their plans are to go optimal injection in October of 2026, with all their recharge wells and monitoring wells having been drilled. They also had to look at, as Adam mentioned, seismic induced seismicity was something that they're looking at, and they have a plan to mitigate that by gradually ramping up the recharge wells. So the project is very large and complex. It shows an example of using highly treated wastewater as a source water, direct injection into a complex coastal confined aquifer as the receiving aquifer, looking to improve water quality, increase water resilience, mitigate saltwater intrusion, and land substance. So just to make sure everybody's still awake, what was the source water component of the Swift Managed Aquifer Project? Everybody ponder that for a little bit. All right, Taylor, what was the consensus? Yep, that is correct. Treated wastewater was the source water. All right, I'm going to turn it back over to Adam, and he's going to discuss the next case study, which is the San Antonio's Water Systems H2 Oak Center Aquifer Storage and Recovery Project. Adam?
All right, thanks, John. So the San Antonio Water System, or SAWS, is the water utility for Greater San Antonio, Texas. So today they get about two-thirds of their water from the Edwards Aquifer, which is a major aquifer in East Texas. But as recently as the 1990s, San Antonio got 100% of its water from the Edwards Aquifer. And since then, they've had to develop other sources of water because, starting in the 1990s, withdrawals from the Edwards Aquifer began to be regulated by the Edwards Aquifer Authority. So that was created in response to a lawsuit alleging that overpumping of the Edwards Aquifer during dry years, especially, was reducing the flows from springs that were supporting the habitat of endangered species. So under the current regulatory system, SAWS has a fixed allotment of water that they're allowed to withdraw from the Edwards Aquifer in any given year. There's a charge associated with it, but it's a flat rate, so the price is the same, you know, regardless of how much they actually pump. But if they don't use their full allocation in a given year, the unused portion does not carry over into subsequent years. So where the level is currently set for the allocation, the volume is enough for, you know, a typical year for SAWS, you know, and especially in really wet years, you know, they might have quite a bit extra water, I guess, available from this allotment that is, you know, above what they actually need in those years. But unfortunately, in dry years, they find themselves in kind of a problem because one of the things that the Edwards Aquifer Authority can do in order to preserve the flows at the springs is to impose restrictions on withdrawals. And so in a dry year, they may see their allocation cut by upwards of 40%, which puts them really in a bind that, you know, then they need to have other sources of water in order to meet their demand. So now that we've set the stage here a little bit, let's start this off with our role-playing exercise, disguised as a poll question. So Taylor, if you want to open this up, please. So put yourself in San Antonio's shoes here. So if you have a fixed allocation of water that you're allowed to pump in a given year and you don't need all of it, what would you do with that extra amount of water? So four choices for you here. So A is, well, we don't need it, so let's just leave it where it is. B, we should pump it out, but then discharge it into a surface water reservoir to store it for later. C, pump it, but then inject it back into the ground into a different aquifer. Or D, pump it, and then see if we can sell it to a different water provider. So what would you do? All right. So this is about kind of the breakdown we often get for this question. So common sense would seem to dictate that option A is the correct answer. It's like, if you don't need the water, why are you pumping it? But given that this is a training about managed aquifer recharge, what San Antonio actually decided to do here was option C, which is they pump the water out of the Edwards Aquifer, even if they don't need it. And then the amount that's above and beyond their demand, then they put back into the ground into a different aquifer. So at first glance, it might not seem like it makes much sense. Why would you pump water out of the ground just to put it right back into the ground somewhere else? But the reason that it makes sense is because of the regulatory situation involved. You know, because the unused allocations don't carry over into subsequent years, and because sometimes there are years when they need more water than they have available to them, it makes sense for them to take as much water as they can possibly get out of the heavily regulated Edwards Aquifer. And then what they don't need right away, they store in a different, much less regulated aquifer, where then they have a lot more control over what they do with it. So that's one reason we picked this case study for this training, because it's kind of unique just in that respect, and just, you know, that we're using groundwater as the source water, which, yeah, otherwise wouldn't maybe seem like a good idea. So the next few slides here, we'll run through our MAR model for these various aspects of the SAWS project. So the intended use of this project is water supply resilience. So the idea that in a dry year, they're not able to get enough water out of the Edwards Aquifer due to potential restrictions. And so by storing water from wet years in a different aquifer, then they have this reservoir, an additional source of water that they can draw from to help meet their demands. So a really good analogy for this is a bank account. So in this case, the source water is the money, the receiving aquifer is the bank. And so when you have more source water available, you put it in the bank and save it for later. And so conceptually, that's illustrated by the figure on this slide. So the blue spikes that point upwards on this figure are times, are showing you volumes of water that are being sent to customers. So that's water that's being pumped out of the ASR storage area and then put into the distribution system. So those are the withdrawals from the bank account. Whereas then all of the green spikes on here that point down are times when they're putting water, excess water from the Edwards Aquifer that they pumped but didn't need, that then they're putting it in the receiving aquifer to store it for later. So these are the deposits in the bank. And as you can see on here, some this the time axis on the horizontal down here shows you this system started operating in 2004. This runs through 2019. For that time period, there are a lot more green spikes pointing down on here. So they made a lot more deposits into their bank account than they took out withdrawals during this time period. So overall, they have created a net storage of water in the receiving aquifer. So the source water, as I've kind of alluded to a couple times, is groundwater from the Edwards Aquifer. So the Edwards Aquifer is a limestone aquifer that has karst features, large caverns and solution weathering fractures in it. As we show you on the map, this blue band on here is where the Edwards Aquifer subcrops, so where it's the uppermost bedrock. If you move to the northwest in this figure, the Edwards Aquifer dips in that direction, so it gets deeper and deeper as you move farther northwest. But then the southeastern edge here of the blue area is the edge of the Edwards Aquifer. It doesn't exist to the southeast. So partly because it's close to the surface in San Antonio, the water quality in the Edwards Aquifer is excellent. So it's really good quality water. They don't have to do any pretreatment to it prior to injecting it into the receiving aquifer other than to disinfect it. The receiving aquifer is the Carrizo Aquifer, which is shown in red. So this is located a little farther to the southeast from where the Edwards Aquifer is present. The black dot that you see on here that's labeled H2 Oaks is the location of the ASR project. So the Carrizo Aquifer is a confined sandstone aquifer. It's about 400 to 700 feet deep. And especially compared to the Edwards Aquifer, the water quality in the Carrizo Aquifer is nothing to write home about. It has a slightly acidic pH at 5.5, and then the water has very high total dissolved solids, iron and manganese. So it is used as a potable drinking water supply for a number of private domestic wells in the region, but it's not necessarily a great aquifer for a municipal system. It probably would require treatment. But one thing you have to remember for an ASR system is that the water quality in the receiving aquifer doesn't really need to be good for a project like this, because we're putting the source water in just to store it there, and then it's the source water that we're going to be taking back out. So the main thing is just making sure that it's geochemically compatible so we don't get adverse impacts from chemical reactions. Now, one thing I want to note about the location of this before we move on, you see the county boundaries on this figure. So H2 Oaks is located in that very southeastern corner of Bayer County. And that is actually a strategic location, because at that location, the Carrizo Aquifer is not regulated by any entity. But if, had they put it just across the county line in either of those two adjacent counties, in those areas, the Carrizo Aquifer is regulated by a group called the Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District. And that has some implications for the project that I'll talk about a little bit more a couple slides from now. The recharge technology that they're using for this project are aquifer storage and recovery, or ASR, wells. So as Jeff mentioned right before the question and answer break, these are kind of a special case of injection wells that have the ability to alternate between injecting water or withdrawing water. So all from the same well. As you see on the map, so far they have constructed 29 wells as part of this system. And total, combine all of those wells together, they have an injection capacity of 74 million gallons per day. Pretty big number. Each individual well, when they're in recovery mode and they're pumping water back out, can pump ranging between 1,200 and about 2,000 gallons per minute. Also, as Jeff mentioned, when talking about injection wells, one advantage of them is that each individual well has a pretty small footprint. And so as you can see, even though, I mean, this whole site covers a big area, the wells themselves don't take up very much land. And so most of the land here was allowed to remain in agricultural production even after the system was constructed. And so that also was kind of a key stakeholder factor to try to help keep people in the area happy and, you know, not antagonize the neighbors as part of this project. San Antonio has learned a few things the hard way over the years through the operation of this system, mainly in regards to corrosion of the wells. The water, both the Edwards Aquifer water and the native Carrizo water, are slightly corrosive. And so they've learned over time that 304 stainless steel for screens in the wells just isn't resistant enough to corrosion. So as they've had to go back and retrofit wells or install new ones, they now have to use the more expensive and more corrosion resistant 316L stainless steel. Originally, they also tried to use an epoxy coated steel for the well casings, try to protect it from corrosion. But whenever you work on the well, it was just too easy to nick and damage that epoxy coating and then allow the steel underneath it to corrode. So since then, they've also had to move to a different grade of steel that's not coated, but is more corrosion resistant. So as I alluded to a couple slides ago, stakeholder engagement was key to the success of this project, because there were a number of people that were already in the area of the project that weren't really excited to see San Antonio move in and build this. There were a number of people in the area that had existing, you know, private water supply wells in the Carrizo Aquifer, and they were concerned about both water quantity and water quality impacts as a result of the H2 Oaks project. So, as I mentioned, you know, this system has a pretty big capacity, and like if all of those wells were pumping at the same time to pull that stored water back out, that would create a pretty big cone of depression in the Carrizo Aquifer. So people were worried, especially those who had shallower wells, that then water level might fall below their pump and then they'd be left high and dry. Well, I mentioned several times that the quality of the Edwards Aquifer water is really good. You know, people were also wondering that, you know, maybe SAWS would change their mind at some point down the road and use a lower quality source water, like say treated wastewater, and that might degrade the quality of water that's in the Carrizo Aquifer. So enough people were concerned and seriously concerned about this that they were able to get a referendum on the ballot to try to annex the area of the H2 Oaks project into that neighboring Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District so that it would be regulated. The referendum failed, so the annexation did not occur. But still, in the interest of being a good neighbor, SAWS entered into negotiations with Evergreen, and they reached an agreement in 2002 to try to address these water quantity and quality concerns. So obviously, SAWS is allowed to withdraw all of the Edwards Aquifer water that they put into the Carrizo Aquifer, but to try to address the concerns about water quantity impacts, they did agree to a limit on the amount of native Carrizo Aquifer water that this system can withdraw due to mixing. So that's 6,400 acre feet per year. To address the water quality concerns that the private well owners had, SAWS did have to agree that they will only ever use Edwards Aquifer water as the source water for this system, and that they can't use treated wastewater or anything else. As part of this agreement, SAWS also had to come up with a monitoring and mitigation plan for potential impacts to the residential wells. And so that means they've had to go out and examine, to date, 166 wells to see kind of where the pump is set and like how vulnerable it might be to low water levels. So in some cases, they've had to lower the pumps in the wells to make sure that the pump will stay in the water even during dry conditions. Some of the wells were too shallow to be able to lower the pump. In those cases, they either had to drill a new well, or if public water was available nearby, then they abandoned the wells and connected the homeowner to the public water system. This little summary figure, is a good kind of snapshot of some of the statistics of this project. And so since they started operating this in 2004, through the end of 2002, they have now put about 189,000 acre feet of water into the Carrizo Aquifer as the kind of the net storage. And so that acre feet is kind of a weird unit, but that's equivalent to 1.1 billion gallons of water that they now have as a reservoir to kind of protect against drought. And so it's a very flush bank account that they have to hopefully make sure they can meet their demands in the future. So we will wrap up this section here with one final poll question. Which of these was a concession that SAWS had to make to existing users of the Carrizo Aquifer? So A, treated wastewater cannot be used as source water. Option B, no native Carrizo groundwater may be extracted. C, SAWS must replace all private wells with public supply. Or D, the H2 Oaks system area was annexed into the Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District. All right, so majority got it right here. The correct answer here is A. So SAWS had to agree that they would not use treated wastewater. They're only allowed to use Edwards Aquifer water as the source water for this system. And so for option B, they are allowed to withdraw a small amount of Carrizo groundwater, so it's not zero. They only replaced private wells with public supply where it was practical. They did not extend water lines as part of this project, and they were able to avoid being annexed into the Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District, but still entered into negotiations with them in order to be a good neighbor and ensure the success of the project. So that wraps up this case study, and I will turn it back over to Kelsey.
Thank you so much, Adam. So what did we learn today during today's training? As you can see from the unconsolidated sedimentary aquifers of the Swift Project in Virginia to the karst bedrock aquifers in Texas, managed aquifer recharge is a process and not just a simple formula or linear flowchart. Depending on the need or the problem you are facing, you can start anywhere on the MAR model. This training has also showed that MAR is adaptable and applicable to a wide variety of aquifer systems. Regarding the Walla Walla Basin watershed, the future is now for MAR. We saw that commercial development threatened Walla Walla River flow rates and lowered water levels so that the ecosystems for bull and steelhead trout were threatened and needed protection. Specific stream flows had to be maintained and water supply resilience was needed. These were the intended uses of this MAR project. Since the Milton Freewater Alluvial Fan was a highly conductive receiving aquifer, recharge via infiltration basins and galleries, as shown above by the Johnson Aquifer Recharge Site, would provide the source water to feed and maintain water levels in the primary and secondary rivers in the Walla Walla Basin watershed. A total of 19 recharge projects were implemented across both Oregon and Washington to put water back into the aquifer. The solution for the Walla Walla Basin watershed could not have been accomplished without stakeholder engagement from both states. You already saw how important community engagement was between counties in the SAWS project in Texas. We didn't have time to cover these today, but here are some other things to consider when developing a MAR project. Section 2 in the guidance document is dedicated to project planning, including stakeholder engagement and regulatory considerations and permitting. Modeling plays a major role in planning a MAR project and is discussed in detail in Section 3.6. Appendix B defines water quality parameters, including physical, chemical, biological, and even radiological. Appendix C provides state, territory, and tribal regulatory contact information. We hope your understanding of managed aquifer recharge and how it can be applied is clearer to you after today's training. Take the time to dive into the fact sheets provided in the guidance document, as well as the 9 other case studies to determine which solution might work for your need. We will now take your questions. Back to you, Taylor.
All right. Thanks for wrapping that up, Kelsey. As she mentioned, we have reached the final Q&A session for this training. So I just have a couple questions for the trainers. Is the Edwards Aquifer similar to the Biscayne? I hope I'm saying that right, which is very susceptible to surface contamination.
Yeah, I would say yes. I mean, a little different setting. It's not a coastal situation like the Biscayne, but I mean, any karst aquifer like this that's shallow, is going to be susceptible to any surface contamination. And the big issue with karst aquifers is just that water moves so much faster through them than it does in a porous media aquifer. So yeah, something that, falls down a sinkhole or, some type of karst feature and then gets into that underground fracture system, can move very quickly and impact people down gradient much faster than you would otherwise expect groundwater to flow.
All right, thanks, Adam. Another question, how do you address the potential for emerging contaminants such as PFAS from being introduced?
Can you repeat that question? I was multitasking when you asked.
Taylor, I'll take a stab at that.
Sure, and I can repeat it for Linda if needed.
Sure. But, you kind of see it in the Swift case study. You really got to look at and think about a lot of things when you're looking at a MAR project and, that potential for introducing any kind of emerging contaminant. You kind of got to think through that. And like at Swift, they basically are looking at it through using the granulated activated carbon. So it's probably going to be some sort of pre-treatment that you're going to be using to try to mitigate any kind of risk of introducing an emerging contaminant into the receiving aquifer. So, but it's something you're going to have to take a look at, and probably your state regulators are going to help you remember to take a look at that when you go to talk to them.
All right. Thanks, John. Linda, did you want to expand any more? Did you want me to repeat the question?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. So the question was, How do you address the potential for emerging contaminants such as PFAS from being introduced?
Let's see here. I think the person who answered it earlier may have gotten to this, but I just want to repeat here in Region 8, before you can inject any fluids into the subsurface, you must first do a thorough evaluation of the water quality. And the water quality for those constituents that have MCLs, they must meet MCLs. And if there's other constituents of concerns that may not have MCLs associated with them, they must meet they must meet like a health advisory or some type of a standard that may be acceptable to the region and sometimes to the state. So you got to have water that meets the criteria before you even can consider inject and allowing an operator to inject. So hopefully that answers your questions. And that's how we address requirements in our regulations.
All
So
right,
hopefully
great.
that address helps a little.
Yeah, thank you, Linda. And thank you, John, as well. I don't see any more open questions in the Q&A pod, so I will go ahead and wrap up our training for today. I want to thank all of our trainers again for being here and for all of you for attending and interacting. And we would like to hear back from you. So please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that is linked on this last slide. I'm also going to throw it in the chat as well. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thanks again, everyone.